This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
In this special Behind the Badge episode of APB Cold Case, we take a look inside the tragic day when a man sets a cold-blooded trap for first responders. His motive is as disturbing as his objective.
This is APB Behind the Badge. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins on a chilly December morning in Webster, a small town just outside of Rochester, New York. It's about 5:30 a.m. when Webster police officer Mark Reed gets a call from dispatch.
911.
With the fire department, 191 Lake Road, for a vehicle that is on fire close to the house.
5-3, Adelbeck.
5-3, send for.
Officer Reed responds along with the fire department to the report of a car fire on Lake Road. As he approaches, he sees smoke rising above the trees. He radios back to dispatch that they have a working fire. And it's not long before Pumper 125 of the West Webster Fire Department pulls up to the scene. That's when Reed hears something. And then he sees firefighters laying in the road. To understand what's happening, we need to go back a little bit, but in time only. We're still at the same location, the house where lifelong resident Arlene Spengler is living on Lake Road with her 62-year-old son, William Jr., and her 67-year-old daughter, Cheryl. Arlene's husband had died a decade earlier, and in the years following his death, Arlene began to experience a decline in her own health. Her medical problems often required the assistance of the local ambulance service, which was operated through the West Webster Fire Department. And those services became more frequent until she passed away on October 7, 2012. Arlene's final wishes included a directive that, in lieu of flowers, donations should be made to the fire department. She was obviously grateful for the first responders who so often came to her aid, but her generous and honorable gesture didn't sit well with everyone in her family. In fact, things had not always been peaceful in the Spengler home. A New York Post article said that in July of 1980, 29-year-old William Spengler Jr. went to the home of a neighbor, claiming that his 92-year-old grandmother, Rose, had fallen down the basement stairs. But an autopsy would show that she died of severe head trauma, and William confessed to bludgeoning her with a hammer over an argument. He told police that he tossed the hammer into Lake Ontario. Spengler was charged with murder, but would later plead guilty to manslaughter in the first degree. He was sentenced to 8 1/3 to 25 years in prison. After serving about 17 years of his sentence, Spengler was released. He returned to the family home on Lake Road, living with his mother and sister. But life wasn't the same after his return. His own sister, Cheryl, seemed to be fearful of him. And she may not have been the only one. Apparently, Spengler made no bones about the fact that he'd been to prison for murder. Retired Webster Police Chief Jerry Pickering explains.
Interestingly enough, he was well known in the neighborhood as Uncle Billy. He was a unique, kind of scary individual. He always bragged about the fact that for any new neighbors that moved in, he went up and introduced himself, let them know that he's the one that killed his grandmother.
One neighbor told a reporter that William hated his sister, and with her mother's passing, tensions in the home were probably high.
The only home he'd ever lived in, other than state prison, was that home that he now co-owned with his sister, and his sister wanted to sell the property and split it because she was fearful of him.
It's now December 24th, 2012, about 2.5 months since Arlene Spengler died. Jerry Pickering was the sitting police chief for the town of Webster at the time.
We're a small agency. We have 34 sworn officers, and we routinely respond to police and fire and ambulance calls. So that evening, I had one command officer working and two officers, which was really light because usually we have 3 to 4 officers and a supervisor working.
It's about 5:30 in the morning. The sun won't be up along the shore of Lake Ontario for 2 more hours. The temperature is 29 degrees, and 62-year-old William Spengler Jr. has been forming a plan. He's armed himself with a .223 semi-automatic rifle, a 12-gauge shotgun, and a .38 caliber handgun. a handgun that he'd just used to kill his sister inside the family home. Spengler goes outside and sets a car on fire. Then he moves across the street and to the north from the family home to a berm on the edge of Lake Ontario. On the opposite side of the roadway is Irondequoit Bay, and all along the narrow peninsula are homes and recreational areas. In this position, Spengler has a view of the burning car. He's set his trap. Now he waits. Someone's called 911, and as we heard earlier, Officer Mark Reed is on the way.
With the fire department, 191 Lake Road, for a vehicle that is on fire close to the house.
5-3, Adelbeck.
5-3, send for.
Along with the police, the West Webster Volunteer Fire Department responds. Firefighter Joe Hofstetter also responds in his own vehicle directly from his home. When he arrives, he alerts sleepy residents and surrounding homes while awaiting the arrival of the pumper.
1-2-32, be advised, came in as a vehicle on fire. It says the house is catching on as well.
Understood, thanks.
Pumper 125 pulls up. Behind the wheel is firefighter Mike Ciparini. He once served as the fire chief, and he's also a lieutenant for the Webster Police Department. Riding with Ciparini is firefighter Ted Scardino. As they approach, they immediately recognize that the fire is close to a structure.
All units responding to Lake Road, getting a second call for vehicle on fire close to the house.
What's the dispatch?
125.
I got a car on fire with an exposure problem.
Officer Reed pulled his cruiser up past the car fire so the fire trucks could have better access.
As he saw the initial fire trucks pull up, he started hearing popping noises. He thought perhaps the car fire, had things exploding on it, like tires or the struts on the trunk lid or the hood lid.
But then Officer Reed sees something alarming.
Then he saw firemen start to go down, and he still thought that perhaps they were being struck by shrapnel from the car exploding.
Yeah, 5-1, start a couple ambulances. We got a couple firefighters down the road.
10-4.
With the officer's request for ambulances, the dispatcher begins to realize this is not a routine fire call.
It's hard to copy. You want an ambulance down there for Lake Road?
Yeah, 10-4.
Okay. So two firefighters are down in the road. At 951, you want me to start the ambulance because firefighters are down? Okay.
Officer Reed sees an occasional flash of light in the distance, and there's a fierce crack with each flash. He knows exactly what this is.
After the police officer saw the muzzle flash, he quickly ran to his patrol car and obtained the assault patrol rifle from our car and engaged with the shooter, just shooting at muzzle blast. Dark night, cold of winter, probably 5:30 in the morning. All he saw was the muzzle blast. Immediately, the gunman started firing at the police officer as well, who then sought cover. Initially, he started firing right from the middle of the street at the muzzle blast. So he actually heard rounds whizzing by him as he was firing at the gunman.
An off-duty police officer from a neighboring department drives up on the scene and realizes that he's in the middle of a shootout.
We had all kinds of other firefighters responding to the scene, and actually an off-duty Town of Grease police officer happened in and realized that shots were being fired, and he actually had his private vehicle fired upon, took two rounds in his private vehicle, backed up and shut off the road to prevent additional firemen from responding to that location. So it was a very chaotic scene. We had an active gunman. We didn't know where he was. We had numerous individuals either dead or critically injured in the roadway, and we had an active fire scene that eventually spread to 7 additional homes. We couldn't send firemen into the location to put out the fires because we didn't know where our gunman was.
All hell is breaking loose. The fire's growing out of control, there's gunfire, and it's almost impossible to see who's shooting. The officer radios to the dispatcher.
shots fired on my end. He went down. I don't know if I hit him or not. He's by a tree.
What for?
Having a hard time here in the dark.
Our police officer immediately took cover in some buildings. The gunman continued to fire at responding equipment. He also had started a house on fire in front of where the car was going. At this time, the house started to go burn really well because he had poured accelerants throughout the inside of it. You know, it quickly turned into a really dramatic scene. We had two officers, one east side of the gunman, one west side of the gunman. So we had an active shooter, which is unusual in that the active shooter was outside. We really didn't have a good idea because he did see the gunman start to run along the old railroad bed east of his location.
Webster Police Officer Mark Reed spots the gunman.
He's on the bank, the north bank of the residence. He's up behind the tree there.
So he's on the north side of the road?
Yeah, for north side of the road.
All right.
Fire a couple shots fired at me.
At this point, only a handful of firefighters and police are on the scene, and a lot's happening. It's hard to say what each of them knew or experienced at any one moment in the timeline. A barrage of gunfire, a fire truck shot up, and a car fire that's spreading to a house. While police are trying to hone in on the shooter's position, there's more gunfire. Firefighter Mike Ciparini and EMT Tomas Kachufka have been shot. Firefighter Joe Hofstetter has also been shot. But he makes it to Pumper 125, still parked in front of the fire, and picks up the radio.
125 to dispatcher.
125.
125 to dispatcher.
125.
We are being shot at. Multiple firemen down. Multiple firemen shot. I am shot. I think we use an assault rifle. Multiple firemen down. Working fire. Fire shot with a firearm.
Understood. 1C32 to copy. Multiple firemen down. Multiple firemen shot with a working fire.
Officer Mark Reed continues taking shots at the gunman, but in the dark, he's only able to see the occasional muzzle flash. Firefighter Hofstetter, still taking cover in Pumper 125, is bleeding heavily. He understands he's seriously injured, and he's got to get out of there. Firefighter Ted Scardino's also been shot, and he too is taking cover underneath Pumper 125. He's between the rear dual axles, but Hofstetter doesn't know that. What he does know is that at that moment, he's in the line of fire.
But he is so cool, calm, and collected. I mean, he's got critical injuries, and he dragged himself up into the fire truck and dropped it into gear, and the other guy's laying underneath the rear duals, drops it into gear and drives the truck down. He can't see where he's going. He drives it like a tenth of a mile down the road, and it goes off and hits a concrete culvert.
As Hofstetter pulls away, he unknowingly leaves firefighter Ted Scardino lying in the road, exposed.
The guy that had been shot, he's got wires arcing over him. He's got seven houses burning. He's getting burned from the fires, but he doesn't want to move because he's afraid he's going to get shot again. And he's bleeding out. It's just incredible.
By pulling the pumper away, Hofstetter's put some distance between himself and the fire scene, but he's still taking his chances inside the fire truck. His only other option is venturing into the open. He's seriously wounded, but he knows police are in the area, and he's waiting for help.
Any idea on status?
312, I have multiple police agencies in the area. We're waiting for the scene to be secured before we can come into you. Just hang tight.
All right, be advised, I'm struck in the lower leg, knee area, and the lower left back.
10-4, brother, hang tight.
Dispatch knows these guys are in trouble. There's a lot of help coming, but the county's armored vehicle, a Bearcat, is still some distance away.
They're not really fast vehicles. It took quite a while for the Bearcat to respond to the scene so that we could have armored vehicle go in with the SWAT team to try to recover injured or deceased.
So we know that firefighters Scardino and Hofstetter are injured, but firefighter Ciparini and EMT Tom Kachufka have been fatally wounded. And because the location of the shooter is still unknown, the fire is burning out of control. 5 houses burned to the ground, and 2 other homes are damaged.
It was hours before the sunlight came up, and we were actually able to see where the gunman was. And I think he was initially spotted by patrol boats, whether it was Coast Guard or Monroe County Sheriff's boats, and then confirmed by a helicopter that flew over.
The chief said that the actions by Mark Reed, the first arriving police officer who returned Spengler's gunfire, were instrumental in saving lives.
It was one police officer. He was on scene within 2 to 3 minutes, but he probably stopped further people from being killed.
Chief Pickering also told me about the young EMT who was tragically shot down by the sniper.
Tomas Kachufka, he was actually good friends with Lieutenant Ciparini's son, was also in the fire department, responded in an EMS capacity. And as he was putting on his gear, he didn't realize or couldn't hear the gunshots and started running up to the truck to help. As he was putting his turnout gear on and running up, he was struck twice and killed instantly.
Police would also learn that Mike Ciparini, who responded that Christmas Eve as a volunteer firefighter driving the pumper truck, was also acting in his role as a police officer once he realized that he and his colleagues were under fire. You're going to hear Chief Pickering refer to the doghouse of the fire truck. That's the area inside the cab that covers the engine. And again, you'll hear him mention the Bearcat, a brand name for a popular armored tactical vehicle.
You know, we have information from one of the firemen that was critically injured that was actually riding in the doghouse with Lieutenant Ciparini. When they came in, and I can't tell you how many, I think there was 70 to 80 bullet holes in the truck from the sniper rifle through the windshield. But as they approached, the assumption was Lieutenant Ciparini thought that they were being shot at from where the car was burning. They didn't realize the gunman was on the north side of where they were. So he let the other firemen know, we're taking fire, we're being shot at. And he put the truck in park, jumped over the doghouse in the front, told the other firemen to bail out, and they actually bailed out right into the line of fire of the bad guy. We believe, we don't know this to be sure, but we think that Lieutenant Ciparini realized and saw Spengler and ran directly at him. He was shot, took one fatal shot to the head, probably within 15 feet of the gunman. So we think that perhaps Ciparini saw him, decided he was going to tackle him, try to take him down. The fireman actually that was struck, critically struck, and told us about the heroic actions of Lieutenant Ciparini, crawled underneath the fire truck and in between the rear duals tires. He was actually struck another time as he laid under the truck.
He's talking about firefighter Ted Scardino, who had tried to take cover underneath Pumper 125. Scardino laid in the roadway for about an hour before he was rescued by the armored vehicle and the responding SWAT team. The fire had spread uncontrollably during that time, so he also suffered burns to his head and feet. Cheryl Spengler's body was recovered from the smoldering rubble of the family home. She'd been shot with a .38 caliber handgun. William Spengler's body was found in his sniper's nest, and it was later learned that he'd shot himself within about 10 minutes of the first shot being fired.
He had armed himself. He had several hundred rounds of ammunition for the AR-15. He had a shotgun with probably 100 rounds of ammunition. He had a .38 caliber handgun with at least 100 rounds of ammunition. So he had really prepared himself for a lengthy fight.
William Spengler's motive would become clear in a manifesto found by police.
He left a note that we located later at the scene that said, he intended to burn the neighborhood down and kill as many firemen as he could, and that was his intent. Well, it's interesting because he lived with his mother, who was elderly, and in her waning years, she had required the assistance of the ambulance on numerous times. Our ambulance was attached to the fire department, West Webster Fire Department. The funeral director for the town that handled her final arrangements had indicated Bill Spengler was extremely upset when he found out that his mother's last will and testament had indicated that money be sent to the West Webster Fire Department. The sad part is it amounted to probably $200 or $300. It wasn't like a lot of money that was sent to the fire department. So we'll never really know, but our inclination is that he had grievance against the fire department because he was upset that money was sent to them in his mother's name, whether he felt the money should come to him. The other thing that really set him off was his sister wanted to sell the property and split it because she was fearful of him. She slept with a .38 caliber handgun, which we believe was the same handgun that was recovered next to him.
Because Spengler was a convicted felon, he should not have been in possession of firearms. An investigation revealed that a woman in Greece, New York, purchased firearms for Spengler 2 years before his homicidal rampage. She was prosecuted and sentenced to 1 1/3 to 4 years in state prison. For the greater Rochester area and beyond, Christmas Eve 2012 was a day beyond anyone's imagination. It shook the community to its core. A well-intentioned gesture by Mrs. Spengler as her final wish to recognize the fire department that took care of her was apparently the catalyst that sent her son into a murderous rage, targeting the very people she wanted to honor. According to the West Webster Fire Department website, Tomas Kachuvka, who was killed in the attack, is remembered as the energetic, fun-loving, and carefree kid with the infectious smile. A young man who loved to play jokes on his two older brothers and whose extraordinary work ethic came from his parents. Tom was a certified first responder and EMT, and he worked as a fire and EMS dispatcher for Monroe County, New York. Also killed was Mike Ciparini, who worked for the Webster Police Department for 19 years and served with the West Webster Fire Department in various roles for more than 25 years. He leaves behind a family and the many firefighters and police officers he mentored. There's a memorial on Lake Road. It's not so much a reminder of the tragedy that happened there. It honors the service and sacrifice of the first responders, the volunteers who were protecting their community in the early morning hours on Christmas Eve 2012. The family, friends, and colleagues of the heroes who were there that day will never forget. It brought everyone closer, not just the emergency services workers.
Locally, in the greater Rochester area, it brought the community together closer than we'd ever been. Police, fire, and EMS, federal, state, and local. We had a massive response from every agency that you can imagine, and just an outpouring from the community.
A special thanks to Chief Jerry Pickering, who retired from the town of Webster in 2014 and went on to serve as the Director of Public Safety for the University of Rochester. This episode is dedicated to the memory of Lieutenant Mike Ciparini and firefighter EMT Tomas Kachuvka, who gave their lives in service to their community. Thanks for listening to this special Behind the Badge episode of APB Cold Case, and be sure to check out our show notes at apbcoldcase.com.
Send your comments to apbbehindthebadge@spawngroup.com. You're listening to APB Behind the Badge, an original Spawn Group production.